What a powerful word. Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to come and share with you a message that God has laid in my heart. Pastor Ted and Pastor Diana talk about a research that I'm currently engaged in completing. I'm actually doing two researches at the same time. I know my kids and my mother. Not my mother, sorry. I just want to make sure that I'm not kicking this one down. My kids have told me that I'm a nut at doing things like this. But anyway, there was a report released back in 2012 by an organization called Evangelical Fellowship of Canada. At that time, the report that came out is actually called Hemorrhaging Faith. What it's basically talking about is, I'm going to give you sort of the top liner, the skinny of it. In essence, what they're saying is simply this, that for every 3 Canadian youth who were raised in Christian traditions, only 1, when he or she reaches the age of 18 to 34, and that's kind of the age bracket they look at, would continue to attend church on a weekly basis. In other words, 2 out of 3 would kind of drop out a little bit. So when we heard about that report, we were excited. When I say we, meaning the kind of the community that I kind of come from, the kind of the Chinese Canadian church, we asked the question, how is it going to be like for the Chinese community? Now, let me apologize up front that I talk for the Chinese community. Not that because I do not care for the Asian community or the border community per se. Because from a research standpoint, there is kind of a limit when you engage in sort of probing questions and things like that. I asked for $30,000 to do this research. I'm volunteering my time and my energy to do that. I can hardly imagine if I were to extend it to an Asian church setting. This might balloon up to maybe $100,000. Right now, I'm already short. So the idea is not so much about me or the community being ethnocentric, but the idea is to find a way to really understand the journey of the local-born Chinese Canadian Christian in terms of how they fare when they grow up. Are they giving up faith, or are they staying with it, or are they moving on to other churches? These are the kind of the mega questions that we need to answer. So let me give you a shout out. If you happen to be a local-born Chinese Canadian, and if you are 13 years old and above, and if you know anybody who are in that category, either they are going to church, or in fact, for that matter, they have already dropped out of faith, may I invite you to participate in the survey. The survey is a very easy site to remember. The site is called tohom.ca. Tohom.ca. Because the project that we have kind of given a name right now is called To Whom Shall We Go? We don't want to be as gloomy as EFC in predicting that it is going to be a hemorrhaging situation. In fact, we don't know. And if we don't know, we're asking the question, where might they be going? To whom shall we go? So if you happen to be in that category, I invite you to go to tohom.ca and take part in the survey. And also, if you happen to know people, friends, who are going to church or no longer go to church, please do that as well. This morning I want to take a look at 2 Timothy chapter 1 from the perspective of intergenerational faith. About 2 years ago, this gentleman, also by the name of Carey, who happens to be the ex-archbishop of the Church of England, he was commenting to the synod of the church in response to the census that the British government did. The British government and the Canadian government have a lot of similarity when it comes to sort of conducting census. Their census, later census 2011, basically said that there are only 59.3% of the British citizens who would register themselves to be a Christian. And you say, well, what is the so what of this? The so what of this is that when they rewind the tape back to a decade ago, 2010, and this is exactly what Canadian government would do as well. For every 10 years, although we do census every 5 years, 1-6, 1-6, in other words, 2001, 2006, 2011, and so on. We only probe the religiosity of Canadian once every 10 years. Same as the UK. Back in 2001, British citizens who registered themselves to be Christian constitute 72%. It's a huge drop as far as Archbishop Carey is concerned. A Canadian is not doing too good either. Back in 2001, 22.8 million of us who claim to be Christians. And then a few years ago when we did the census of 2011, we're talking about 22.1. So 0.7 million of us have dropped our moniker or our affiliation as a Christian. So Archbishop is saying the Church of England is just one generation away from extinction. And as far as he is concerned, he traces the fundamental root cause of this phenomenon back to the inability of the church to bring up the younger generation, to bring them up in such a way that they would be steeped in Christian faith. Well, you wonder what are the things that affect our younger generation when it comes to giving up their faith or keeping their faith. A few years ago, this gentleman, Christian Smith, who is a renowned sociology of religion professor at Notre Dame University, led a study in the United States specifically on the religion affiliation in the cohort of 13 to 17, the youth. He called it National Study of Youth and Religion. In his study, he concluded that there are 6 variables. Depends on the combination of it that would impact and influence the way the youngsters would either stick with the faith or give up the faith. 2 of the variables are people factors. The first one, parent. Second one, mentor. In other words, if we do not have strict and heavy influence or great influence by parents, our youngsters would not be able to grow up in such a way that they would be steeped in the Christian faith. At the same time, if we do not have good mentorship in church or in our Christian community, we are equally stuck. As a matter of fact, when we look at 2 Timothy, Paul did talk about these 2 groups of cohorts. As far as mentorship is concerned, I'm going to leave it with you to study a little bit more deeper. Go to chapter 3, starting with verse 10. Paul talked about his relationship with Timothy, asking Timothy to model after his own faith. But today, I want to focus on the role that the parent would play in terms of affecting the faith of our younger generation. Other research also said the same thing. I'm going to skip this one. When it comes to affecting the faith, there are researchers that talks about 2 different roles that the father and the mother would play in the journey of our younger generation. For example, they would say the father's influence would be more around what they call moral supervision, giving our younger generation a sense of right and wrong. But mother is important in terms of shaping the religious supervision of the younger generation. No wonder Paul said in chapter 1 verse 5. And he pointed to Timothy's mother and grandmother, Lois and Eunice, and said, "Hey, I recognize the fact that you have been greatly influenced by the woman in your life. By the woman in your life." One of the biggest problems of being a parent, in shaping or not, in terms of the faith of the younger generation, is simply this. That the younger generation look at the parents, especially look at their lives, and look at how they practice their faith. One of the biggest complaints about parents, and it's true with Christian Smith, it's true with other research, it's also true with Hamilton Faith, and hopefully we'll find out a little bit more in terms of the To Whom Shall We Go project. Is that the younger generation accuse the parents to be hypocrite. Now, Paul is using an interesting word here to talk about the need to counter the hypocrisy of being a parent. He used this term sincere faith. Sincere means, and I don't have the Greek word here, enupokritos or enupokritos. It means a genuine faith, no pretension. Let me give you three instances that I believe to be a genuine expression of our faith in front of our children. The first one has something to do with practice of authenticity. You know, we Asian, and I look at you, many of you are Asian, and let me just give an apology to my Caucasian friends a little bit. I talk about the Asian sort of values a little bit. We were raised in such a culture that put in a lot of stock on face, shame. That's the kind of external value. There's really no pursuit, no genuine pursuit of God in our lives. Another author by the name of Kinder Bean, who is also a co-worker of Christian Myth, who wrote this book called Almost Christians. She talked about the fact that the reason why the American youth were leaving their faith is because the parents are passing down a watered-down type of a version of a Christian faith to the younger generation. But she did find out there was an exception. There was a group that was an exception. And there was the Mormons. The Mormons were able to bring up their younger generation in such a way that they continue to go to church. And not only that, if you and I know the Mormons, especially the boys, when they reach the age of 17, they devote themselves to short-term mission. And for that matter, another finding of Hamilton Faith tells us this, that if a youngster experiences short-term mission with their parents when they grow up, there is a higher likelihood that they stay in church and with the faith. Kendra Dean said it really well. The Mormons devote every morning to Bible study and prayer to a person at 7 o'clock. The kids come along. They participate. In such a deep religious experience, they will not live their faith. In my own study, I interviewed a gentleman, 33 years old, and I seldom found an interviewee who would give me a glowing report on how he was raised. He said to me, "You know, my parents are my heroes. No matter what happened, no matter how busy they are, they committed themselves to going to church every Wednesday for prayer meeting. They committed to church ministry on every weekend. And I knew my dad sometimes went through a bad period of time in terms of unemployment. But every Saturday night, My family door is open to welcome friends and brothers and sisters to have a small meal. Well, of course, when they got, you know, more money, the meal may be bigger. But nonetheless, they practice hospitality. They practice fellowship. For them, faith must be authentic. Faith must be authentic. A second thing I want you to know, in terms of practicing sincere faith, is a practice of transparency. We Chinese love our faith so much that we do not want to admit our vulnerability. Even now, when Pastor Diana was telling the kids, the most difficult things of the three things we teach them is what? Help me. Why? Because we don't want to admit our own failure. I have a friend who served with me in an organization. A year ago when we met, we start with prayers. And I asked, "Hey Owen, is there anything I can pray for you?" Literally, he was in tears. He was in tears because, you know, I just came back from Toronto visiting my daughter. Now, his daughter was actually a priest in the Anglican tradition. And I said, "What's up?" He said, "You know, I just can't believe it, that their marriage is at the brink of a total breakup." And I said, "What's going on?" "Well, there's a lot of things. But when I was talking to my daughter, I said, hey," let me call her Grace, I'm making it up. "Hey Grace, you mean I didn't teach you how to reconcile differences when you have a fight between you and your husband?" Grace shot back, "Dad, you never did." "Well, what do you mean?" "Remember that when we grew up, whenever you had a problem with mom, you would always go to your bedroom and you close your door. Yeah, sometimes I heard you guys shout at each other, but you never taught us how to deal with failure, how to deal with vulnerability." No wonder. When our children look at us, when they deal with their own failure, they have no model to look at. They have no one to look up to. Owen told me this. Since then, he changed his perspective. It is important, absolutely important, to share our failure, our vulnerability with our kids, so that they know that the only way out of this is our complete reliance on God and His salvation. You see, we're not practicing something that only happens on Sunday. We're practicing 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. You know, I see my fellow congregants on Sunday, but my daughters see me 7 days a week. How you behave, how you express yourself, how you fail, it's all in their eyesight. They got a front row seat. The last thing we need to practice is practice what we preach. I did this interview in Ottawa with this gentleman. He's complaining about not only his parents, but also his parents' friends in church. You know, we Chinese want success for our children, right? I ask, in my PhD study, I interviewed 13 second generation and 5 pastors. I asked the 13 participants, I said, "Who picked the school for you?" "Well, usually I pick the school, but my dad and mom have a lot of say." "What about the subject? What about the area that you focus in, the area that you study?" "Well, again, my dad." "And what are the subjects?" and some of the participants can speak in Chinese with me a little bit. And one of them said, it's all about C. You know what C is? 工程師, 會計師, 律師, lawyers, accountants, doctors. I said, what about 牧師? What about pastor? Oh, no, no, pastor's not good. Pastor's not good. No way, Jose. Joe said this. They would come and they would worship God, tell and sing songs, and that would give God everything. Like, we bow down to you, God. But I'm just like, no, you're lying. Like, you clearly put academic over God. Like, you know. You get angry in your son because he wants to be a pastor now. But then you know you have a daughter and she wants, or maybe another son who wants to go to law school, and you praise him. What you should have done is that you should be praising your son because he wants to be a pastor. Because there ain't that many pastors around. You know, 3 months ago, this message hit home. I don't know how you call your parents, or especially your father, back home. How do you call your dad when you go home? Did you call him dad?
Yeah.
Did you ever try calling him, hey, Tad, not dad?
Yeah. Then you get like, hey, don't call me that.
Vulnerability, openness, transparency. You see, my daughters, these are terms of endearment, right? It depends on their mood. My older one, she come home, hello, Nachi. My name is Nina. Hello, Nachi. I said, what? My younger one, when she come home from university, how you doing, Enoch? Enoch. Now, that's all good, right? Trying to joke around with you. Ah, but when they need something, you can hear the talk. Hi, Daddy, can I talk to you? You're like, there's some money. Also, there's some coins. But when there are some serious stuff, they won't talk to you. Hey, Dad, can I talk to you? Right. 3 months ago, I was driving my younger daughter, who is now studying in the city of Waterloo at Wilfrid Laurier University. And any one of you who knows the drive from Toronto to Waterloo is just about an hour long, right? About 20 minutes into the drive, Agnes, hey Dad, can we talk a little bit? And it kind of caught my attention because I'm driving, I was actually speeding. No surprise, Chinese guy with the wheels. What's going on? And she go like, Dad, you remember last year in February, not last year, this year, meaning this year 2014 in February, we had, you know, a school break in university. I don't know whether UBC has it or the university, like kind of a study break a little bit. You know, you take a week off, you go skiing and break your leg. No, she actually participated in a short-term mission with Power to Change to Yukai, as they say. I said, Dad, you remember that? Yeah, I remember that. I'd like to go again this year. And I knew Agnes enough that she was already make up her mind that I'm not going to, you know, find a way to change her. So we talk, and then she go like, Dad, not only do I want to go to a short-term mission in February, I'd like to engage in a longer, do you have something like a longer short-term mission? Is it oxymoron? A longer short-term mission? 2015 May and June with Power to Change. And then she go like, you know, I really hate studying business. I'm really thinking to get into ministry after I graduate. This particular quotation came to my mind front and center. What am I going to say? What am I going to say? I tell you, the only thing I can say is not why. The only thing I can say is how much. Right? I want to go to short-term mission, and I'm going to pass the tin can around, And if the funding is not enough, what do you do as a parent? You top it up the best you can. So the only thing I can say is how much? Folks, every day your kids are looking up to you. They know whether you are actually practicing the values that is deeply rooted in the Bible. Or just simply something that you say to them, do what I say, not what I do. This one hit home. Hit home. Now, if you do all that, does it mean Bob's your uncle? You know what Bob's your uncle means, right? I'm pretty British, really. I start with Kerry, you know, and I'm gonna talk about UK, you know, short-term mission. I'm gonna give you one more slide on the British Isle. Does it mean Bob's your uncle and Louise is your aunt, as they say? No, no. I'll give you this example then. You know these guys, right? Mumford & Sons. How many of you know Mumford & Sons? Put your hand. Thank you. You are really on top of things. Because when I go to the Chinese church, forget about Mumford & Sons. I pull out a picture on Katy Perry. They go like, huh? Who is Katy Perry? You know? I said, folks, if you don't know Katy Perry, then you lose your daughters when she come ask you, can I buy this pair of high heels? You understand what I'm saying? Right? Marcus Mumford said, I'm not a Christian. Well, big deal. But here's the big deal. Marcus Mumford's parents, John and Eleanor, actually the lead founder of Vineyard Movement in UK. You know where Marcus Mumford was born? He was actually born in California. When John was schooled under John Wimber, who is the founder of the Vineyard Movement. I don't know whether you've been to the church. I've been to the church back in the early 90s. It's a fun church. You know, you can't imagine a pastor, when he preached a sermon, would ask the congregant, hey, I forgot where to find this passage. Can you find it for me? You know, in a Chinese church, you got put out right away, right? I mean, when you're preaching, you don't know where the passage comes from. Really unorthodox kind of a stuff, right? So you may argue that Marcus was actually brought up in steep tradition, charismatic tradition to boot. Guess what? Marcus, are you a Christian? Well, I don't know. I believe in God. A Christian is a loaded term. It's a loaded term. I see a little bit of Christian influence is still in them. Right? I mean, you heard songs like Awake My Soul, not the Chris Tomlin version, but his own version. Right? So you've done all that. You've been a good example, good dad, good mom. What does it mean? Well, there is also something missing in the children that we need to make sure that they follow through. And what they need to follow through is what I call a gospel-centric teaching. The kind of version of the gospel these days are all over the map. Take a look at this. Joel Austin, you know him, right? A key example of wealth and health gospel. 2008, there was an article written about him in Time magazine. And Time magazine reporter interviewed this gentleman from Cleveland who was just laid off. But he was just on his way. He packed everything. He sold his house. He's moving his family to Texas to attend his church. When he was asked why he do that, because that's where I'm going to get rich. Gospel message is equated to wealth and health. And this is Christian Smith again. The youngster that he studied, he came up with a version of a gospel, a version of faith. He called it moralistic therapeutic theism. What does it mean? Christian Smith said this: God is something like a combination divine butler and cosmic therapist. What is a divine butler? I don't know about your prayer, But at times I found myself doing this, God, can you give this to me and give it to me and give it to me now? I don't know about, do you have pizza here in Vancouver? You don't, eh? Okay, from Toronto there's a chain called Pizza, and one of the biggest sort of, I don't know, brand commitment, if you can call it that way, is that they must deliver the pizza to your house within 30 minutes. If they don't, free of charge. And sometimes I find myself making this pizza prayer to God. God, give it to me in 30 minutes. If not, then what? But I find myself in that mood, you know what I'm saying? That's the kind of, God is my butler. And He is at my command, not me at His command. He's always on call, takes care of any problem that arises, and professionally helps his people to feel better about themselves and does not become too personally involved in the process. I want to have a relationship, but not too close, huh? Just, you know, a little bit of distance between you and me, God. And please mind your business until I need you. And in so doing, I mind my business as well. Or for that matter, is it the kind of the gospel that focuses on what Dallas Willard would say, gospel of sin management. We reduce the gospel of the kingdom that Jesus preached and told us to proclaim to the ends of the world to merely the message of forgiveness of sins, as if sin were our whole problem. I suggest to you, what Paul wants Timothy to really pay attention to is what it means to be gospel-centric. And that gospel-centricity, that kind of faith, in my opinion, is encaptured by the following phases: by the gospel, for the gospel, and of the gospel. First of all, let's take a look at what Paul is saying in verse 9. Paul said, God has saved us and called us to a holy life through or by the gospel. I don't know about your background, but I was brought up in a Chinese church tradition that totally focused gospel on conversion only. What is important? What is important? The evangelistic meeting. What's important? What is important is to lead people to Christ. Now, I'm not suggesting this is not important. As we can see from this verse, God has started by saving us first. But folks, God did not stop there. God also called us into a way deeper life. A life that is characterized by what Paul said, a holiness. You see, gospel of holiness is defined not by what we do, but by our relationship with the Lord and in the Lord. Another researcher by the name of Kara Powell, she leads this institution called FYI. It's not for your information, but Fuller Youth Institution, found at Fuller Seminary in California. And in her study, she asked the 17 years old and the 18 years old American youth, who is a Christian? You know what the typical answer coming back? The typical answer coming back is, Christian are those who go to church. Christians are those who do this and do that. In other words, according to her result, the version of Christianity that the American youth would subscribe to is a version that is defined by what we do, not by who we are. What Paul is trying to tell us is that holiness is the pursuit of who we are in the Lord. Our spiritual being is separated for the Lord's use. Holiness defines not only our lifestyle, but it defines our lives, that we are totally set apart, totally dedicated for His sake, and totally devoted for His kingdom. my good friend who used to be the dean of Regent College, who is now the president of Ambrose University because of my connection with CNMA, Christian and Missionary Alliance, Gordon Smith, will say to you that one of the key messages in the Bible is not so much about the Lord tells us to make disciples. One of the key passages in the Bible that people often neglect is John 15:4. Abide in me as I abide in you. Or in today's language, hang out with me as I hang out with you. And of course, the hanging out goes deeper than just hang out to have a coffee, to have a drink, to have a coke, to have a meal. God invites us to get as deep as possible into His being. And sometimes holiness is something really difficult to grasp, right? Because at once it is behavior. You recall in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 verse 7, Paul told the Thessalonians, for God did not call us to be impure, but to live a holy life. But the fact that there is an external expression means that there is an interiority in our lives that is closely tied with the Lord. You see, I told you I was studying PhD, and I told you I researched into the second gen. That was only one of my two majors. The other major that I'm focusing on is actually leadership studies. Someone asked me, what is a Christian leader? What are the key things that differentiate Christian leaders? Well, you know, in the secular world, we look a lot in terms of our skills. I look a lot in terms of competence. But Christian leaders, first and foremost, must be called by God. But the second most important thing is the character of the leadership. And holiness is the fundamental ingredient that defines and shapes not only a leader, but a follower of Jesus Christ. Funny, people said, so do you have any special idea when you go teach a leadership study? I always start with this topic, and depends on how many sessions I end with this topic. The first topic is not leadership, followership. A key followership, abide in Jesus as He abides in you. And of course the last one is succession. There's always an expiry day. You better look up, you know, look out for who is going to take over a little bit. So by the gospel, we are called into a holy life. Not only that, of the gospel, Paul said, I was appointed a hero and an apostle and a teacher. And this one to me speaks to Paul's purpose and identity in Christ. Paul mentioned the fact that he is a hero, he is an apostle, and he is a teacher. Not because he wants to talk about what he does, but because that's his calling. It is one of the key things we need to make sure that we do is to help our youngsters to figure out their calling in life. Tom Clydesdale, another researcher, the focus on a cohort of Christians getting into university, and he found a number of interesting characteristics that come to describe the group of people. One of them is simply this. He said, few are shaped by purpose. Few demonstrate direction and recognize their interdependency with communities and with God. In other words, we, especially Chinese, want to pass them down a set of values, as I said, that is centered on what we call worldly success. And yet God is not calling us to be successful. God is actually calling us to be faithful. Faithful in what we do, faithful in who we are. I suggest to you, if your sons and daughters happens to be lawyers, and happens to be a businessman, and happens to be a doctor, happens to be an accountant, that's all good. But you got to ask them, are they being a doctor, an accountant, a lawyer of the gospel? Of the gospel. Paul said he was called as a hero, apostle, and a teacher. What about you? Who are you? Pastor Ted, that is a song, Who Am I? What's in your name? I have been toiling with the idea of how am I going to end my dissertation, the last section. Because I was totally inspired, a little bit, in that sense. I hope you don't misunderstand me. By Jason Mraz. You know Jason Mraz, right? I mean, I'm coming to a place that I can talk about this stuff. In the Chinese church, they go like, Jason, what? not the famous song, not the other one. Here's a song called Details in the Fabric. I don't know whether you heard of it. Details in the Fabric? In the refrain, he said, hold your own, know your name, and go your own way. In many respects, our younger generation grew up asserting their faith, claiming their freedom to be independent, wanting to be a grown up, distancing themselves from their parents. We need to bless them to hold their own. We need to bless them to know their name, and we need to bless them to go their own way. But we must make sure we do so in the name of the Lord. That they hold their own identity, because that identity is given to them by the Lord. They know their name, because that name was written in the palm of our God. We ask them to go their own way, not because there is a brokenness between us and them, but because we want to bless them, that they too will flourish, they too will be nurtured. And in that regard, I don't care where they are in the Chinese church, or where they are in FRC, in 10 at 10, Crucible, Resonance, Tap, you name it. When I say I don't care, I do care a lot. I don't care meaning I do not care whether they have an affiliation with an ethnic church. What I care about, their name in the Lord, their way in the Lord, and their destiny in the Lord. Help them to shape their identity. Help them to figure out their calling. Sometimes calling comes as young as 13. That's why we do this study, 13 and above. Help us. Help us to do that. The last one. Paul exhorted Timothy to join him in the suffering for the gospel by the power of God. You see, our version of the gospel is not the wealth and health gospel, but a faith that beckons us to suffer and sacrifice for the kingdom's sake. Hemorrhaging faith. One of the key findings is this, that if the youngster have good experience with the Lord, they tend to stay with the Lord. And then when I look at the report and I try to understand what they mean by good experience, they typically talk about God answered their prayers. One of the things that I found out through my own little research is that actually life misfortunes would greatly affect the destiny, or not the destiny, but greatly affect the kind of the religiosity of the youngster as well. Broken relationship, health problem with the family, father was unemployed, and they felt like God has distanced them. It reminds me of this saying, right? You heard about this quote, right? Everybody's got a plan until they got punched in their face. You know who said that? Mike Tyson said that. You can Google it, you can find it yourself. What Mike Tyson is saying, hey look, everything's hunky-dory, we go in church, we are all insulated. Sunday school's good, Pastor Diane's story is good. Pastor Ted's preaching is good. And when I go home, everything is hunky-dory. There's no sense of suffering or price to pay. And that reminds me of another quote by Chuck Swindoll. He said, I'm convinced that life is 10% what happens to me and 90% of how I react to it. Having problems in our lives is not necessarily a bad experience. Having challenges in our life, even in life misfortune type of situation, may be a lesson that God has sent for us to learn. After all, we all read James chapter 1, and you may not understand the nuance. James chapter 1 basically said this. He did not say if we fall into temptation. He said when we fall into temptation. That Greek word is really specific. It means sooner or later, one way or the other, you will fall into temptation. And the word fall is also a very funny word. It is not a deliberate falling. Oh, I see a temptation, I fall into it. No. In fact, sometimes it happens. It comes out of nowhere and you kind of go, oh, 2011, May 19th, I was going to go to a Greek island with my wife. Hang out. This is the first time we're going to hang out together without our children. After 20, I don't know how many years. I'm not going to tell you how many years. Right? All's good. And then later on, I'm going to study in Rome and Florence. Yeah, my school is over at Spokane called Gonzaga. They have a campus in Florence and in Rome. Beautiful. Beautiful. The flight was, 10:30 from Toronto, because it's usually a red-eye flight when you go to Europe from Toronto. 6:50, I got a phone call from a specialist. Because here's the problem. I've been having ear pressure problem. Make a long story short. Did a biopsy. 6:50. The specialist called me. The first thing he said was not, Mr. Wong, you're good to go, enjoy vacation. You have a glass of Greek wine for me, or something like that. No, the first thing he said to me is, Mr. Wong, when are you going to come back? And then for the next 20 minutes, he told me that I was diagnosed with cancer. One of these Southern Chinese men cancer. I don't know what you heard of it. It's called nasopharyngeal cancer. It's a really long syllable, multi-syllable disease. Hey, I thought I got my path all set up, Hey, God has another way. Now that's life misfortune. What Paul is saying in terms of join me in suffering for the gospel is actually a deliberate act. There's intentionality behind this. Because we as Christians must risk our lives. I love it when I'm working with the president of Christian Missionary Alliance, when he's shaping his vision, one of the things that he said is that we must risk all to win the next generation. We must risk all to win the next generation. About a week ago, I got a newsletter from him. He said he just came back from Iraq. Just came back from Iraq, northern Iraq specifically. And they visited a couple of, and we don't advertise, so we have CNMA churches there, but they actually CNMA churches. Right? He said he bumped into this dentist. This dentist said he, make a long story short, he was there really to help out, to combat the evil, and to lend a hand. We know that not long ago, our Japanese brother Kenji Goto was killed. And what did he do? He just wanted to save the children from war and poverty. This gentleman said, look, people have come from all over the world to join ISIS and are now here destroying and killing and bringing fear. Now Christians are coming from all over the world and they are bringing help, love and hope. Which religion would you choose? I'm going to be a Christian and help them. What's special about this letter, you think? Let me ask you first. Who did he send this letter to? What did I say? father-in-law. Why father-in-law? Here is the story behind it. His father-in-law must be really well off. I wish I could have one of those father-in-law type, right? He found out that he was going to go to Iraq with the Christian Relief Organization. You know what he did, his father-in-law? He donated $200,000 to this organization and asked them not to send his son-in-law to Iraq. As if $200,000 is the bounty on his head. You don't go, Diana. Here's $200,000. But not to you, but to the organization. Well, if you give $200,000 to Diana, maybe he would consider that. It's just wrong priority, right? It was a joke. You see, there is an intentionality here. Our faith requires a kind of a refinement, and sometimes the refinements come from suffering for the Lord. I'm not standing up here saying that I'm a saint, that I'm capable of doing it myself. But I wish. And this is my kind of my sample, my example, that I might have the courage if I'm called that way. $200,000, folks. The Lord has entrusted children in our lives. It's up to us. It's up to us to live the kind of faith requirements, the kind of faith examples that Paul was talking about in this passage, in such a way that we no longer tell them, do what I say, not what I do. You can say, we are those who walk the walk, talk the talk. Let me conclude. To the parents, transmit the faith with God's mercy and grace. To the children, experience God in terms of His holiness, purpose, suffering, and sacrifice, and claim a faith of your own. Let us pray. Father, thank you for the opportunity to share your word. We ask that even though our sharing has to stop, that your word will continue to ring in our ear, stay in our heart. Talk to us in such a way that we'll be totally abide in you. That our faith is genuine and authentic. Though incomplete, our faith would be transparent. Though insufficient, our faith is one that is rooted in your truth and the divine values. So that we can help our younger generation to claim a faith of their own that is gospel-centric, that is for the gospel, shaped by the gospel, and has a purpose and identity that is rooted in the gospel. Thank you so much for giving us an opportunity to share your word. We pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.